Okay, one thing is that there's nothing magic about 60 minutes. So don't even bother timing it. Whenever I'm done talking, that's when you should get your final masses. But it's going to take me a while to get through these things I need to talk about, including the three slides I told you about. Just remember, this is both lecture and laboratory material. But I've told you before, I think, not today, but in lecture, that there are three major categories of transport processes that can put things into or out of cells. Do you remember the categories? No, those are conditions. Those are not processes. The three categories are vesicular transport, transport involving a vesicle, right? Active transport, and passive transport. Now, vesicular transport doesn't actually involve something moving directly through the membrane, right? It's kind of a cheating mechanism because the vesicle will just... I mean, the membrane will surround a particle to form the vesicle, then that vesicle is now inside the cell, but the particle never went through a membrane. The other two categories, active transport and passive transport, involve something directly going through the membrane. And those two are distinguished, passive and active, on the basis of the requirement for additional energy, some outside source of energy. I don't want you to think of passive transport as not requiring energy. That's not true. It requires energy. But passive transport already contains in itself the energy required to move the particles. So there is no requirement of any additional energy expenditure. Active transport, on the other hand, will never happen unless you supply additional energy, external energy. And the focus of today is passive transport. Now that I've mentioned those three, I want to talk about passive transport specifically. Passive transport is diffusion. And like I said, since it's passive transport, there is no additional energy required for passive transport. The energy is already built into the system. The source of that energy is what we call a gradient. Gradient is a pretty general word that roughly means a difference in some measurement at one place versus another, compared to another. So there's all kinds of different gradient types. For instance, what we call voltages are gradients. They're gradients of electrical potential energy. When you make a measurement at one slot in the electric receptacle, compare it to the other measurement, there's a difference. That's a gradient. A pressure gradient can exist, which is why water comes out of the pipe, not going into it. Gravitational gradient is why things fall. But the gradient that we care about in today's lab is a concentration gradient. That's a different kind of gradient. Which just means if you measure the concentration at point A and you measure it again at point B, if there is a difference in those concentrations, then you have a gradient in place, a concentration gradient. And something I'll repeat many times in the lecture room in Unit 3 is the important fact that a gradient, including a concentration gradient, is a source of potential energy. It can do some work for you. Well, in the case of diffusion, passive transport, that gradient is the source of energy. That's why it's built in and you don't have to supply any other additional energy. The gradient itself drives the diffusion. Now, another thing about diffusion, which is more properly called net diffusion, is that it is a directed process. It occurs in a direction. Specifically, that direction is down the gradient. Things diffuse down the concentration gradient. That's another way of saying that particles diffuse from where they are more highly concentrated to where they are less highly concentrated. That's what I mean by down the gradient. And it always occurs in that direction, from high concentration to low concentration. So that's why diffusion is a directed process. But it's a directed process that is based on random movement, which kind of seems oxymoronic, perhaps, to some of you. Self-contradictory. How can something that is random movement result in directed movement in a specific direction? Well, the random movement is simply the thermal motion, the random motion of particles in any real material. Anything above absolute zero, things are moving, right? And in we're not talking about solids here. They're still moving, but they're kept in place, more or less. In fluids, though, gases and liquids, things are freely moving around. Randomly, as individual particles, and we call that random motion Brownian motion. After a dead dude named Brown. So that's the randomness. Every individual particle is going at its own speed, in its own direction, at any given moment. As a population, it's randomized, though. So how does that lead to net diffusion, which means movement of particles in one direction more than another, specifically from high concentration to low concentration? Well, I think it might help to just imagine doing a little experiment without actually going through with it, using people to represent particles. So this is a big room, like a gymnasium or something, just any big room. Open room, though, there's no furniture in it, just walls. So it's like a container with liquid in it. And the people involved each represent a particle. Time is stopped at I don't allow time to pass until I start the clock, but I arrange things first. So I get the people to huddle together in a tight group in the middle of the room. And I also individually just randomly choose a direction that each person is facing. Because when I start the clock, whichever way they're facing, that's the way they're going to walk in a straight line until they hit something. Just like a particle will move in a straight direction until it hits something. Now, we really would be working in three dimensions. This is a two-dimensional example. But the concepts are the same. All right, so at the moment, there is a high concentration of particles here and a low concentration of particles everywhere else, right? So a gradient is in place. And then once I have people arranged, I'll say, okay, let's start the clock. Everyone start moving in whatever direction you're facing until you hit something, and then bounce off in an appropriate direction and continue walking until you hit something again. That's how particles act. Well, if you are any of the people in the middle of this group, those particles aren't going to get very far, right? They're immediately going to run into someone else, another particle. So they're just going to be bouncing off of each other. Then there are the people on the periphery, the edge. Some of those people will just randomly be facing toward the interior of the group, right? So they won't get very far either. But some of the people, just randomly on the periphery, will be facing outwardly. Let's just say this one is. So that person's going to walk until it hits the wall and then bounce off, and so on. The more that happens, the more individual particles leave this high concentration, the more likely it is that other particles will now be on the edge, and if they're facing outward, they can leave as well, right? So if I go to lunch and come back and people are still cooperating, there will no longer be a gradient because they'll all be equally spread out, bouncing off of each other. Doesn't matter where you measure the concentration, it'll be the same everywhere pretty much. In which case we say the gradient has been dissipated. When the gradient falls to zero, meaning there is no difference anymore, then there is no more tendency for movement of particles in one direction more than another. It doesn't mean the particles stop. They're always moving individually. But net diffusion means that more of the particles are moving in one direction than in the opposite direction. So there is net movement in one direction. All right, and that's why random motion can lead to directed net diffusion. Does that make sense? All right? That's diffusion. And there we just only had one particle type. But another real world example, since that wasn't really real world, is just putting a sugar cube into a glass of water. You have two different kinds of particles in that case, right? Sugar particles, water particles. At the very first moment when you put that cube into the water, there are two gradients right away. Because there's a high sugar concentration in the cube, zero sugar concentration in the water around it. That's a gradient for sugar. As simultaneously and independently, there's also a water gradient. Because there's a high concentration of water where it's water, and a zero concentration of water in the cube. So two separate gradients exist, or however many different particle types there are, there's going to be separate gradients. If a gradient exists, meaning the concentration is different at one point versus another, then the gradient is the tendency for diffusion to occur. The tendency is a requirement, but it's not a sufficient requirement. It's not enough for there just to be a tendency. For net diffusion to actually occur, there has to be a gradient, that's the tendency, and there also has to be a way for that particle to get from A to B. And if something blocks it, something prevents it from getting from A to B, then the tendency is there, the gradient, but it won't actually move. All right, those are the requirements for net diffusion. Well, in the sugar cube and water example, there's two gradients in place, that's the tendencies, but also there's nothing stopping either particle from moving down its gradient. So each particle is going to move down its gradient. The water is going to move from where it's water to where it's sugar, down its own gradient, in other words, from high water concentration to low water concentration. The sugar particles are going to move down their own gradient from where it's highly concentrated sugar to no concentration of sugar. Each one is just going down its gradient, though. And that is simple diffusion. Nothing blocking it. All right. Sometimes, though, there are membranes involved. Let's look at the slides to talk about this. This is slide 10. Let me turn this off. So you have two chambers, one on the top, one on the bottom. This is just three different points in time. This is the same chamber on the top. And it's really broken into two sub-chambers because this dashed line in the middle represents a membrane, and more specifically, it is an example of what's called a selectively permeable membrane to permeate. Means to go through. So selectively permeable refers to a membrane through which certain things, but only certain things, can pass through or permeate. Other things are blocked. Well, in this case, you really have two different particles here, but we're ignoring the water particles. That's why it's just shown as a blue background. What we care about here are the orange dye molecules, whatever those are. And in this case, the membrane is permeable to these orange dye molecules. They can get through the little holes in the membrane. All right? And at time zero, notice that you have a gradient in place, because there's a high concentration or a higher concentration of solute particles on the left than on the right. It's zero on the right, so anything above that is a difference. There's a gradient in place. That's the tendency for diffusion to occur. And since they're not being blocked, since they can get through the membrane, they also fulfill the second requirement, the ability to move from A to B. And that's exactly what they do. They move from left to right simply because there's more particles on the left than on the right. So there's going to be more movement from right to left, from left to right. Okay? And if you allow this to happen for a while, it will come to equilibrium, which is another way of saying that there is no longer any net diffusion happening. Doesn't mean anything stopped. It simply means that now there is just as much movement in one direction as there is in the other. And there, so there's no more net diffusion. In this case, equilibrium was reached because the gradient went to zero. And when you don't have a gradient anymore, there's no more tendency for movement in one direction than another. So net diffusion stops. That's not the only way equilibrium can happen, but that's what happened here. On the bottom, exactly the same thing is happening, except we have two different particles. So just like I said for sugar and water, each different kind of particle has its own gradient, and only a particle's own gradient matters. So the orange dot molecule gradient is the only reason the orange molecules move from left to right. It has nothing to do with the purple gradient. The only reason the purple ones are moving from right to left is because they're going down their own gradient. All right? And in this case, they can both permeate through the membrane, so there is net diffusion of both. And once again, they'll come to equilibrium. It's two separate equilibria, one for each of the two gradients, because both gradients went to zero in this case. No more net diffusion of either particle. Is that all clear? All right. So that is, all of that goes by the word diffusion. There's a special case of diffusion, though. Passive transport is diffusion in all cases. But sometimes we don't use the word diffusion because it's a special case of diffusion. And that special case of diffusion is called osmosis. All right, it still is diffusion, importantly. But we call it osmosis only if two things are true that make it the special case. One of those conditions for it to be called osmosis is that the particle type being moved or diffusing is not a solute like we've been talking about in these dye molecules. Instead, it is a solvent particle. Now, that's the chemical criterion. Any biology textbook will say that it's water, but that's only because in biological situations, the solvent is always water. It's not the only possible solvent, though. All right, so it's movement of solvent particles, not solute particles. That's one condition, but that's not enough. The other requirement for it to be classified as osmosis is that those solvent particles need to be moving through a selectively permeable membrane. And notice that in the sugar cube water example, that was not true, right? One of the particle types, water, was solvent in that sugar cube example. But water was not moving through a selectively permeable membrane to get from A to B. It was simply going down its gradient. In that case, it's just diffusion of water. It's not osmosis. When you have osmosis, though, the solvent particle is able to move through the selectively permeable membrane, but the solutes are not able to. Okay? Is that all clear? You have a question? Yes, that's one way. It can be based on size or charge. The things I was talking about in lecture today are ways in which, even though you might have a gradient, you don't have net diffusion through the membrane because the membrane blocks the actual transfer. But everyone's clear on what osmosis... Go ahead. No, there's... this is how... reverse osmosis water treatment works. You have a membrane, artificial membrane, through which water is moving, but solutes aren't. Osmosis is not only biological, and that's why the definition is not really supposed to be water only. It's supposed to be any solvent moving through a selectively permeable membrane is osmosis. Okay, so let's look at an example in slide 11. Here you have a piece of glassware called a U-tube with a selectively permeable membrane at the bottom. So it's really two chambers, the two sides of the U. And they are both solutions, right? Aqueous solutions. Water's the solvent, and you have solute particles in there as well. In this case, it says labeled as sugar, but it doesn't matter. There are some sort of solute particles, these green balls. And if you look at the picture, you can tell there is a lower solute concentration here than there is here, right? So there's a gradient in place. There's two gradients, though. A gradient for water and a gradient for solute particles. Now, I didn't actually give you a definition of osmosis yet. I just told you what the requirements were. And I want to give you a definition because I think most textbooks state this in a backwards and therefore confusing way. I don't know whether you've read definitions of osmosis in textbooks already, but most textbooks will say something like osmosis is the movement of water from a region of low solute concentration to high solute concentration. Have you ever read that? It is true, but it sounds like it's an exception when you say that water is moving from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, because I told you that all diffusion, which osmosis is, occurs down the gradient from high to low concentration, right? The reason that definition is true is because it's talking about solutes, not water. And I just told you a little bit ago that only a particle's own gradient matters, not so the only thing that moves the water is the water gradient, not the solute gradient. This is why I think it's a backwards way of defining it. So it is true that osmosis is movement of water from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, but think about what that means. What does low solute concentration mean? It means high water concentration. If a solution has a low solute concentration, that means it's very watery. A weak solution, not a very strong concentration, right? That means it's very watery. And it's the wateriness that counts for osmosis, not the soluteness. All right? A high solute concentration, conversely, means low water concentration. So, a more direct way of defining it would be to say that osmosis is movement of solvent particles, water for biology, from a place of high water concentration to a place of low water concentration through a selectively permeable membrane. Do you see what I'm trying to get at there? That low solute concentration is just a backwards way of saying high water concentration. Okay, so on this U-tube, you have a low solute concentration on the left, high solute concentration on the right. Therefore, you have a high water concentration on the left, a low water concentration on the right. Two different gradients, though, because they're two different particles. The two gradients, one for water and one for sugar, means that there is a tendency for both of these particles to undergo net diffusion. There's a sugar gradient, which is the tendency for sugar to move, and things move down their gradient. So sugar has the tendency to move from right to left. That's down its gradient, from high concentration to low concentration of sugar. But I just told you that this is a selectively permeable membrane through which water can pass, but not solutes. So the tendency is there, but it's not going to happen. Sugar's not going to get from right to left. It can't get through the membrane. Completely independent of that gradient is water's gradient. That's the tendency for water to move down its own gradient. And that's in the reverse direction, but it's still from high to low concentration. It always is. Right? It's high water concentration on the left, low water concentration on the right. Therefore, there's a tendency for water to move from left to right. And water's not blocked by the membrane, so water will move from left to right. Water's a solvent, and if it's diffusing through a membrane, then that's osmosis. Now, is all that clear? Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly what I want you to imagine in a second. First, let me talk about the right side. Okay, this is the same U-tube a little later. This has come to equilibrium as well. But notice when water moves, when water's the only thing that can move, because the sugar can't get through the membrane, right? So as water osmoses, that means you're removing material from the left and you're adding material to the right. And the more you do that, the more the level in the right side increases and it decreases on the left side. Right? That makes sense, correct? Well, in this case, this thing came to equilibrium because the concentration gradient was fully dissipated. By removing water here and adding it here, you've made this a little stronger and you've made this a little weaker until they came to equal concentrations. And with a zero gradient, that means there's no more tendency for osmosis. Okay, so that's kind of the same equilibrium that we saw on the previous slide. But now I want you to imagine what you just brought up. Start out exactly the same, except with no sugar at all on the left. There's still two gradients in place, right? They're still in the same directions. Sugar still can't get from right to left, so it won't be able to. But on this pure water side, water is going to be able to move from left to right, just as it can here. But if this is pure water to begin with, it doesn't matter how much water you move from left to right, you're still going to have pure water on the left, right? And therefore, it's still going to be more watery than the right side. So you're never going to get to the situation where the gradient gets to zero. There's always going to be a tendency for more water to move to the right. It'll come to equilibrium for a different reason, though. The more water moves to the right, the higher the level gets, the more gravity is pulling down on that taller column of water, of solution. And when the force of gravity, which is trying to push water back to the right, to the left, exactly equals the force of osmosis, which is trying to move it to the right, then those two forces will counteract each other and it will be at equilibrium for a different reason. Okay? That's osmosis, though. Any questions on any of the definitions so far? Then let's go to 12 and talk about tonicity. Tonicity refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur. Now keep in mind that a plasma membrane is very similar to these artificial membranes in these examples. A plasma membrane is selectively permeable. Certain things go through it, certain other things don't. And a plasma membrane is a boundary between two solutions. The liquid component of the cytoplasm, which is called the cytosol, is one solution on one side of the membrane, namely on the inside of the membrane. Everything external to the cell is also a solution, right? That's another aqueous solution. And between those two is a selectively permeable membrane defining the cell. So a cell in its extracellular environment is a possible situation for osmosis to occur. And therefore, tonicity applies to this situation. Okay, tonicity is the general word, but there are three categories of tonicity indicated on the top. Those are the adjectives, but they also have noun forms: hypotonicity, isotonicity, hypertonicity. Now listen carefully to this, because the packet might be wrong. The author of the packet uses these words incorrectly, I think. So listen to me, do it correctly. These words, isotonic, hypotonic, hypertonic, should never be used to describe a cell. And the author of the packets does that, makes that mistake. These words should only ever be used to describe the environment around a cell, not the cell itself. That's one important point. Now for the difference between the three. Once again, this seems backwards, and so it's going to be confusing to a lot of you, at least at first. The reason it's backwards is for the same reason that the textbook definition of osmosis seems backwards. Because you're talking about solutes when really what matters is the water, not solutes. Osmosis occurs because of the water gradient, not because of the solute gradient. Okay? But unfortunately, whoever came up with the words based these words on the solutes, not the water. If you think carefully about what these prefixes mean, though, or prefaces, then hopefully you can make sense of it. Hypo means what as a prefix? It means below, right? As in hypodermic, below the skin. A hypotonic solution is one that has a lower, that's the hypo part, lower solute concentration than the cell does. The cell has a certain concentration, right, of solutes, because the cell is containing a solution. So that intracellular fluid has a certain concentration. If the environment has a lower solute concentration than the cell does, then that environment is hypotonic. But that's a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution is more watery than the cell. Because if it has a lower solute concentration, that means it's more watery. It has a higher water concentration than the cell. Does that all make sense? Equate in your mind hypotonicity with wateriness. It's more watery than the cell. Well, that means there's a gradient with respect to water. So there's a tendency for osmosis to occur. And if water can get through the membrane, then it will. On the top row of this figure, we have a typical animal cell, an erythrocyte, a red blood cell, in a hypotonic environment on the left. Hypotonic environment is going to cause water to move into the cell. Water always moves, if it's going to net osmose, water is always going to go from high water concentration to low water concentration. It's going to go from more watery to less watery. But in this case, hypotonic by definition means more watery, so it's going to move from outside to inside the cell. Well, that's going to swell up the cell, of course, right? It's going to increase the volume. And as we talked about already, animal cells don't have cell walls. They have only a plasma membrane, which is pretty flimsy. So if it's a hypotonic enough solution, or if it's in there long enough, it will take in enough water to make it explode, not just swell. And that explosion is lysis. The process is called lysis, which, remember, means splitting, like in hydrolysis. The cell is said to be lysed when it explodes. And you probably have already guessed that is not good for the cell. It kills the cell. So animal cells do not do well in a hypotonic environment. Now let's look at the other extreme before going to the middle. Hypertonic is just the opposite, but it's also backwardly defined. Hyper means above, but it's referring to the solutes, not the water. So a hypertonic solution is one that has a higher solute concentration than the cell does, which is a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell. Once again, there's a gradient for water in place, but the gradient is in the reverse direction now. Water's always going to go down the gradient, but here it's more watery in the cell, less watery outside. So water is going to go from the higher water concentration in the cell to the lower concentration outside the cell. The cell's going to lose the water. That's going to shrivel the cell up. The shriveling of an animal cell in a hypertonic environment is called crenation. And crenation, even though it's the opposite of lysis, is also bad for the cell. When it shrivels up, it will no longer live.
Crenation might be
only an N instead of an M. Yes, don't misspell it. Okay, so iso as a prefix means same. But careful with that. Isotonic simply means that the environment contains the same overall solute concentration as the cell. It does not at all mean that they have the same solutes in them. So you could, like in today's experiments, perfect example. You have an external concentration, the environment, that in which the solute is sugar, right? In your experiment, sucrose. But inside inside the cells, which is the other solution, you don't have sucrose, you have starch, mainly, as the solutes. Two totally different solutes, but it doesn't matter what kind of solutes they are, because once again, the only gradient that matters is water gradient. Therefore, if you have an equal concentration of solutes both on both sides of the membrane, inside the cell and outside the cell, that means that those two solutions are equally watery, right? A one molar sugar concentration on one side of the membrane, a one molar salt concentration on the other side. Different solutes, but same wateriness. And it's the wateriness that matters. So that's why in an isotonic environment, a cell won't take on more water than it leaves off. There will be movement of water both into the cell and out of the cell at equal rates. And therefore, the volume of the cell won't change. And that's the ideal situation for an animal cell. It won't lyse or crenate. It will stay nice and healthy. And this is exactly why part of homeostasis in our bodies is devoted to maintaining osmolarity, concentrations of extracellular fluid, so that the cells don't die. All right, that's for animal cells. Let's look at the same environments for plant cells. By the way, these are always relative words, these tonicity words. You can't say that a solution is hypotonic, period. It's only hypotonic compared to a certain cell that's in it. It depends on the cell. You see what I'm saying? It's always a comparison. But if you put a plant into a plant cell into a hypotonic environment, hypotonic still means the same thing here. It means it's more watery than the cell is. So water wants to osmose into the plant cell. But the plant cell can tolerate that because in addition to its plasma membrane, it has a very rigid, cell wall that can hold that pressure. So it's going to come to equilibrium, not because there's no gradient, but similar to the gravity one I talked about. When the force of osmosis exactly equals the force pushing on the fluid by the cell wall, then it will come to equilibrium. And the cell will be in a nice turgid state, swollen or turgid state. That's the healthiest environment for a plant cell. Now, this is an isolated plant cell, but in a real plant, there are billions of cells, right? And this is why even a green tiny stem of a seedling can be erect like a woody tree. It's an erection much like an erection in a penis. Except in a penis, it's blood pressure. In a plant stem, it's an erection because each individual cell is taking in water by osmosis and swelling, but they're connected to each other, so they're all pushing on each other, and that keeps it erect. And if you forget to water it for a while, eventually it will no longer be hypotonic and it will start falling over. If you catch it in time, just give it more pure water that will restore the hypotonicity and the water will go into the cells again. So that's the best condition for plant cells. If you look at it in hypertonic solution, the same thing happens. Water leaves just like it does from an animal cell. But the water is inside the plasma membrane, which itself is inside the cell wall. So when the water comes out of the cell, the plasma membrane peels away from the cell wall. And that process is called plasmolysis, which is potentially problematic as a word because it ends in lysis, but it's just the opposite of lysis. A lysis is rupture of a cell, of an animal cell, in a hypotonic environment. Plasmolysis is shriveling of a plant cell in a hypertonic environment. That will kill the plant cell. Well, plant cells, or plants, can survive isotonic, which is the ideal for animals. They can survive that, but it's not ideal. Because just as much water is leaving as is entering, and therefore the cell is flaccid, it's limp, not turgid. It can survive that, but it's not going to do as well. Any questions on any of these definitions so far? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can, but that's not because it's no longer holding the pressure. It's because it's going to influence movement of ions and other things through the membrane. But you can also kill yourself by drinking too much pure water because it disrupts that osmotic balance. All right. If no questions on that, then let me go on to the next thing, which I want to talk about the report. Now, you just recently handed in your salt water, and you haven't gotten those even graded yet. So I want you to get your numbers here today and clean up properly, because there's a lot of mess on this lab. Not just potato pieces sitting everywhere, which you need to clean up. But also, where the sugar is can be a mess, sticky and stuff, so wipe it down if necessary. Anyway, I want you to get your numbers and make sure everyone has them. And I want you to make sure you take a picture of your whiteboard that you're going to create, which I'll talk about in a minute. But that's all you need to do here. And then I kind of want you to forget about this experiment until after the test. Focus on the upcoming lecture exam, all right? Don't even try to start this report, at least until I give you the grade for your previous report. So put it on the back burner, but make sure you have everything you need for today when you leave. The thing that really throws people in this report is how to properly make the graph. Well, specifically, what to do with the graph. What is, you know, any graph, as we've talked about, has dependent variable, independent variable. Where do they go? Independent goes where? Right, and what's the independent variable? Right, concentration of solution. What units? Molar, capital M. What's the dependent variable? Right, now you're measuring mass, remember. That's all you're measuring directly. Those masses are your raw data. And I say R because data is a plural word. I hear people say data is all the time. It's data R. Anyway, you're directly measuring mass. Those are your raw data. You use those raw data then to calculate change in mass, which is not really a measurement. That's a calculation based on your measurements. And in science, we use delta notation to mean change in something. So I'll just abbreviate it as change in mass, which would have grams as the units. A change is a difference. Mathematically, there's two ways you could calculate a difference, right? You could subtract A from B or B from A. What's the proper way of doing a change in mass? Change in mass equals what? Is it final minus initial, initial minus final? Right, it's mass final minus mass initial. And it makes sense why we do it this way. If you have a higher mass at the end than you did at the beginning, that means you've taken on mass, right? The potatoes have taken on mass. Final would be bigger. Therefore, bigger minus smaller is going to be a positive number. A positive change means a gain. If they end up being lower mass afterwards, then you're going to have small minus large. That's going to be a negative number, right? A negative change in mass means a loss of water. Clear? Okay. I don't want you to graph mass. You need to graph change in mass. And as I just said, change in mass can be positive, negative, or zero. Therefore, don't put zero down here on the bottom. Zero is going to be somewhere in the middle of your y-axis. I'm just drawing a line from zero. It's just one of the grid lines. right? Because you need to be able to accommodate positive values and negative values and zero values, if possible. I mean, if they come up. So that's change in mass. Now, let me just put a few dots here to represent data. I'm not saying that's how yours is going to look, but they look linear enough to justify drawing a line, right? And remember, a line of best fit doesn't necessarily go through any datum, the singular of data, but it gets as close as possible to as many as possible of those points. That's not much of a line. Don't hand draw your line. That's going to lose you points right there. Use a ruler. Draw a straight line. Or do it by a computer if you really prefer to. Just like for this last one, though, whether you do it by hand or by computer, the image of it needs to be inserted into the Word document. You're only uploading a Word document. That's it. One docx. Okay, anyway, this trend line, just like we talked about before, let me straighten that out, is a predictive device, right? If you use interpolation. Here's where people get confused as hell. So I'm just going to tell you specifically how to do this. And even that is probably not going to be enough. Probably some of you are going to do this incorrectly anyway. But there's one question in the report that asks you to figure out what the solute concentration inside the potato cells is. And this is, of course, not something that you're directly measuring, right? You're not measuring any concentrations, let alone the concentration inside cells. So people say, how in the hell do I know? Well, this has to do with the definitions I just gave you for tonicity. Specifically, isotonicity. If an environment is isotonic, it means whatever the overall solute concentration is for that extracellular fluid, it's the same as the overall solute concentration inside the cell, right? And that overall solute concentration inside the cell is what the question's asking for. So that's the key to getting it. You don't get it by directly measuring it. You get it by figuring out what the concentration of an isotonic solution is, which is the same as the concentration in the cells by definition. Does that all make sense? You sure? An isotonic solution, by definition, has the same solute concentration as the cell. That's what makes it isotonic. So if you're asked to figure out what the solute concentration of the cell is, that's another way of saying what is the concentration of an isotonic solution. Does that make sense? Well, I'm going to go on since you're not answering. How do you figure out what an isotonic solution is, though? Now, you're doing three different solutions, but it's really unlikely that any of them is going to be perfectly isotonic. What does it mean, though, to be isotonic as far as change in mass is concerned? It would be no change in mass, right? Only if there is no change in mass is the environment isotonic. So, that's where the trend line comes in. You try to figure out what concentration on the x-axis corresponds to zero change in mass. Well, you simply find where zero, or where the trend line crosses the zero line on the y, and read straight down to the x-axis to get that value of concentration. What this tells you is that even though you didn't measure necessarily this concentration, I mean, even though you didn't have a solution that was this concentration in your experiment, the trend line says that if you did have this concentration, you would predict a zero change in mass, which by definition would be an isotonic solution, and therefore by definition that would have the same solute concentration as the cell, which is what you're trying to figure out. Now, did that make things more clear or less clear? Okay. You sure? Okay, so do it that way. And what are your three concentrations? 0, 0.3, and 0.5? Okay, so don't write them as 0, 0.3, 0.5 evenly spaced. I guarantee you some of you will, but don't. That's not how they are on the number line, right? There's more distance between 0 and 0.3 as there is between 0.3 and 0.5. If you don't have them properly spaced, then they're not going to make the line correct. So don't do that. Do it exactly as I said. All right, that's that experiment. That's all you really have to do other than cleaning up for this experiment is get your final numbers. And, I'm sorry. No, that's not the only thing. You also have to make a whiteboard drawing. And that's important because you get bonus points for that if you include a picture of that in your report. So your whiteboards are here. I need one whiteboard per group to be drawn. And this confuses people too, so I'm going to tell you exactly how I want you to draw them. Divide it into three places and draw a single plant cell in each of the three parts of the whiteboard corresponding to the three levels of tonicity. All right, label them. Label one hypotonic, one isotonic, one hypertonic. And then you also have to draw symbols to represent particles. There's three symbols that you need to use. Different symbols, you know, different shapes, for instance. There's a symbol for water molecules. Where do you find those? Both inside and outside of each cell. There's water on both sides, right? But depending on the environment, there's going to be more water on one side than the other. So make it look like that. Put a lot more water inside for which tonicity level? Hypertonic. That's one symbol. You also have a symbol for sucrose molecules. Where do you find those? Well, there aren't any in the zero concentration one. There aren't any inside the potato cells on any of the three. Their sucrose is found only outside in the 0.3 and the 0.5. So draw them only there. The third kind of particle is starch, which is only on the inside of every cell. All right, so there's three different gradients: a water gradient, a sucrose gradient, and a starch gradient. The starch wants to get out because there's a tendency, there's a gradient, but they're blocked. They can't get out. The sucrose wants to get in but can't get through the membrane, so they don't. The water can get through, and that's why it's osmosis. Water is a solvent, and it's going through a membrane. But direction it goes will depend on the environment. So for each of the environments, draw arrows to indicate which way the water is traveling. Label that all correctly. Give me a key to your symbols so I know which one's which. Show it to me, and when I approve it, everyone in the group take a snapshot of it so you have a picture to insert into your report. Also importantly, I'll just repeat, like I said last time for the first report, you're sharing data. Everyone in the group has the same data, but that's it. You have to make your own graphs. You have to make your own writing, or everyone involved will get a zero. Don't let that happen. All right? Obey the rules consent form, in other words. The only other thing besides all of that is to observe these containers. And this also confuses people. You have strawberries here, you have raisins here. It's totally separate observations. But what confuses people is that they see two containers of strawberries where there's really only one container. Yes, I realize in reality it's two containers, but they're labeled before and after. So you're supposed to imagine this is the same container later as this. Therefore, there's one condition, not two. There's one condition, and you need to figure out tonicity-wise what that condition was that would make this happen for each of these two. Does that make sense? So write down your observations for that, and cleaning up, and that's it for today.